On the morning of February 15th, 1984, I woke up next to a ruminant mammal dressed in a chiffon nightgown who began to bleat sweet nothings into my terrified ears. On September 11th, 1984, I sacrificed my third leg for the greater good of the human race. On September 15th, 1984, with the help of $600,000 and a plastic surgeon named Dennis, it grew back. On October 7th, 1984, I drank 6 gallons of my own urine in a 3-hour period. I won the bet of $900,000, and I beat a prominent radio instructor to a pulp when he couldn't pay. 1985, I attempted to commit emotional suicide and accidentally scarred 3 nuns in the process. The nuns excommunicated me from every church in the tri-state area. Take that, Kevin Samsell!
Okay, so I am here with the indomitable Kevin Samsell, who is most recently the author of A Common Pornography. Kevin, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm doing fantastic. We're doing this at a very late hour. Thank you so much. We can blame the G-line for the perhaps strange quality of the subsequent conversation. But yes. I wanted to start off, I regret that I am unfamiliar with the version of the book that you put out in 2003, but the introduction that precedes this edition, describing your panic attack in August 2008, suggested that this would be some kind of harrowing five-hanky affair, some really deep-seated torment that one would have to experience. But I was pleasantly surprised to see a broad emotional range, a lot of humor, and the like. And I'm curious, to what degree the visceral spectrum was in place with the original version of the book? Did adding additional moments as you went along complicate matters? Maybe we can start here.
Yeah. Well, the first edition, I think, was pretty much mostly like childhood stuff, mostly stuff about me growing up and my memories. And a lot of it was kind of funny, you know, semi-nostalgic stuff. And there was like a couple of things that, you know, as I got older in that book, it was only a 60-page book, but as I got older in that book, some of the vignettes talked about the pornography stuff and hiding the magazines and stuff like that. But I feel like this version, I went a little deeper into that stuff. And on top of that, of course, there were recent things that have happened, like the death of my father in early 2008. And then subsequently, all of the weird, dark stories and family secrets that I learned after that. So what happened was I added some more stuff about my own personal stuff into the book. But there's also all of these weird things about my dad, about more stuff about my brother, Matt, and more stuff about my sister, Linda, who, as you know, has a kind of a disturbing story thread in the book, especially at the beginning. So there was, I think the original version was a little more sweet and kind of funny. And I think this one goes a lot deeper with some of that stuff, and there is a more of a varied range of stuff. It's kind of a crazy book that goes all over the place, I think.
Well, you've written a lot of sweet and funny material. I'm wondering if you sort of distrust this to some degree, or whether this was a way of stretching the emotional range to basically say, hey, Kevin is serious as well, and maybe there are possible dangers in this given the rather libertine confessional nature of this book.
Yeah, I don't know. What do you mean by distrust?
Well, I mean, I'm curious, since the original version of the book was sweet, and the later version of the book has this darker quality, and I'm wondering if there was, whether you distrusted your inherent sweetness, the sweet quality in your writing to some degree. You need to beef things up, and whether mining from these dark territories is something of a risky proposition.
No, I think it's mainly just about the perspective. Like, my perspective before my dad died and before I found out all these stories, my perspective with the original version of the book, which came out in 2002, I think, or 2003, they, you know, it was just my perspective from that time. I was just trying to remember things from my childhood. So I can't go back and change the way I thought and felt about stuff, because I know all this stuff about my dad now, of course. So, and I don't know if it necessarily changes my, knowing this stuff about my dad and these things that he did. I don't know if it necessarily changes the feelings I have for the things that I did as a kid, you know, like, I don't know if it really paints them a different way or colors them a different way. You know, you experience things and you remember things a specific way. And just because you learn new information later on doesn't necessarily mean that what you felt or experienced was a lie.
Yeah.
It was what you felt and experienced in that moment. And, you know.
Well, on the other hand, memory, as the poet Olin Miller says, is the greatest liar of them all. And you have indicated in the author's note that you conducted interviews, and you've sort of alluded to that in this last answer, and there are photographs near the end, and I'm curious how you can be absolutely certain that every memory that you had is absolutely true. I mean, certainly you can probably get the emotional impact of that memory, but maybe we can talk a little bit about that. There's also, well, let's start on this topic, and I'll throw some more things at you.
Well, I think the chapters in the book, I've always felt like they were very short chapters, for one thing. I sort of prefer to call them vignettes almost, because they're almost just like little scenes. And I think that's just the way memory works with a lot of people. And I think you'll read a lot of other memoirs where people take their childhood experiences and they really, like, you know, whether it's through speculation or whatever, they really kind of flesh out those stories and they give people dialogue and all this stuff. I don't necessarily do that in this book, except for a little bit later on, like, you know, when I was a teenager, like in my late teens or whatever, it's a little bit easier to remember certain dialogue and some exact quotes from people. I think there's not a lot of super exact details with some of the chapters. And I think that's why some people respond to it a little bit, is because there is a certain haziness about some of the pieces. Yeah. And I tried to also write some of the stuff from the point of view of what I was feeling at the time. Like some of the chapters where I'm really young, I tried to kind of use that sort of mindset and that sort of like vocabulary to describe, you know, some of these things. So
I'm wondering if the degree or the severity of your memory impacted the length of a particular installment, and whether remembering specific details presented more information to chew on, or perhaps dwelling upon only a few details created a rather protracted chapter.
Yeah, I mean, I just think, like, when I was writing the book and when I was expanding from that earlier version, I would sometimes just kind of have to sit there and think, like, okay, what are some other things that happened when I was a kid? And, so, you know, and I would talk to friends and I would talk to my family. I went back to Kennewick a couple of times and, like, drove around, just tried to, like, jar memory about things. And, you know, I think it's easy for anyone, really, to take out a piece of paper and write a list of just, you know, weird memories from their childhood, just in like one sentence.
Yeah.
So in some ways, when I was putting the book together, I would do that. I would remember something, and I would say, like, oh yeah, I remember like how we used to watch Big Time Wrestling all the time, you know, or like you know, oh, I remember having to go to that, you know, that CCD Catholic school thing, you know, and you just have like these, you know, you just remember things sometimes like that. And so, you know, I just jotted them down and I would try to, and then I would kind of take turns going through each of these notes and I would try to write a chapter about it. And sometimes I would have really, good details to flesh it out. And sometimes it was a little bit more like minimal and, like I said, kind of hazy maybe.
Yeah.
But also, like, emotionally, I think when you go through things as a kid, there are certain times when you remember something being really, really devastating. And like, there's the chapter in here about seventh grade, and I totally remember that year being like this terrible year for me. I was just like, I just had checked out, you know. I didn't really care about anything for some reason. I didn't have any friends. I like never showered, you know, and I just felt, it was just like a really gross year for me. And I remember that day where I stayed after school and, you know, miss half this teacher, and I think that's her real name, actually. Yeah. Like, you know,
you think.
I remember, yeah, exactly.
Did you consult schools or anything to find these little details out, or did you just not even consider?
You know, the name stuff, like, I think with the name stuff you can be a little bit more lenient, because there are a lot of people's names that I changed anyway, and I think that's just, you know, like just the way memoirs happen, is sometimes you change people's names. Because
was Harper legal on your ass, or
what? I had a phone conversation with the lawyer, yeah. As we were going through the whole editing process of the book, and I think I talked to them once, but you know, it was kind of a long conversation, and she just kind of asked me certain things like, oh, what, you know, does this person know that you're writing this or whatever. You know, it was really kind of minimal. I don't really remember having, when I was talking to her, I don't really remember having like anything super major that we had to settle. Yeah. The only thing was, there was a picture of, there's a chapter in the book where it talks about my dad becoming really good friends with this 10-year-old girl, and how we just thought that was really weird, and we kind of followed them around and spied on them and stuff. And I found a couple of pictures of this girl in my dad's stuff, and we were going to put a picture of her in the back of the book. And the lawyer said, oh, we probably can't do that. That's probably not a good idea. You know.
Well, what specifically was wrong with this particular individual?
Well, I think it was mainly because the chapter I wrote about her, it sort of implies some sort of inappropriate relationship.
I think I can guess that chapter.
Yeah. And so, like, I don't really know if they were having an inappropriate relationship. But I think putting her photo in the back of the book would have been, probably would have been not very classy.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, and, you know, that chapter sort of just goes hand in hand with what you're saying about, you know, you never really know if certain things are really, you know, true, or it's just my perception.
Yeah.
Like, and I didn't even necessarily say that in the chapter, like, oh, we thought that he had an inappropriate relationship. But the way it's written, I think, you know, it just kind of leads the reader to think that's why we were following them around.
I'm glad we're talking about this. I'll get back to judgment later, but I actually wanted to talk about something else first. At the end of the book, you write about your son. I wonder if he'll move on in a few short years and feel nostalgic later. Now, this raises two interesting questions. First off, how much do you view this book as almost a legacy that you're passing on to your son? And additionally, since you were writing these sections decades after the events, I'm wondering if you experienced any emotional incongruity in revisiting a memory based solely through text. Did you feel the text accurately reflects what you were experiencing? Was there a disconnect? I mean, you're a much different person now than you were then, or perhaps change may be overstated when you're dealing with almost a textual transposition.
Well, let's see. Let me break that down a little bit. The first part of your question about my son.
Yes. Sort of a legacy.
Yeah. I don't know. I think my upbringing is really different from his upbringing. Thankfully so, because I think the thing I say in the book, or imply a couple of times in the book, is that I grew up in a household where there wasn't a lot of affection, and there wasn't my parents, you know, I was the youngest of the family, and my parents, especially my dad, didn't necessarily pay attention to what I was doing or what I was interested in. And the way I've brought up my son, even though his mom and I haven't been together for a long time. We still raise him with a lot of affection and a lot of love. We support him in a lot of ways, you know, with whatever he wants to do. I just got engaged to my girlfriend, and my son really loves her, and we have a really great household there, and we're just very supportive of him. We don't try to sway him to do anything, and he has his own interests. You know, I grew up being like a music freak and a football freak, and you know, and then later on, like, you know, like sex fiend, like, you know, like whatever.
And, are we all sex fiends to some degree?
You know, he's you know, it's a different generation. He's into manga and video games, and he's
I hope he's not sexting anybody.
I you know, he doesn't really seem super interested in that kind of stuff. He doesn't have a Facebook page, you know, and I don't know if I would have had a Facebook page, you know, if it existed back then either. I don't know. But yeah, it's a different generation for one thing, but it's a very different atmosphere at our house with him around. And he has shown a lot more interest in writing and stuff, actually, like in the last year or so. Yeah. So I think it would be really cool if he does, you know, like start writing and doing some of that stuff. But
that's this question of legacy. I'm curious, just from a father and a writer standpoint, mm-hmm. what did this text mean to you in terms of passing it on to your son like this? Or was that, yeah. Am I possibly overstating things? I was just kind of curious. I mean, you don't need to have any bona fides. I think it's very clear how you feel about your son, that last answer. But I'm curious about this.
About this, the textual legacy.
Yeah. In a certain way.
Well, I talk about my life up until the point where my son is born, and then it kind of fast forwards to the death of my father. So I don't really talk a lot about my son in the book. I sort of felt like I didn't necessarily want to write about him a lot right now in this book. I kind of felt like maybe that was another book, actually. Mm-hmm. And that might be something that I take on, you know, in a couple of years. I felt like it would be weird for him. Like, he's a freshman in high school this year, and I didn't want to write about him while he's in high school and have him feel like all self-conscious and, you know, maybe have his teachers or friends like read those parts of the book, you know. And so part of it is kind of out of respect to him. It's out of respect to his mom, you know, and you know, just out of respect for his privacy and,
sure,
you know. But I think he's excited that I have a book out. I think it's interesting to him that I have a book out about my life. I don't know if he quite understands necessarily the whole concept of a memoir, you know, but and he's read some chapters in the book. He hasn't really read the whole book, and I don't know if he's necessarily interested, but I've showed him some chapters, and I was like, oh, you should read this chapter, I think you'd like this, you know, because they're just like one or two page chapters. Mm-hmm. And I think some of them are kind of funny, I think he is excited about that. As far as like a legacy for me, though, like that whole aspect of it, I'm really happy with the book. I'm happy with the way it came out. I'm happy with the fact that that I revealed a lot of like weird, like uncomfortable, embarrassing stuff about myself. I think it's like an opportunity for me to sort of like unload some of that stuff, you know, not in like a therapeutic way or anything. But I think I always tell people, like, especially writers, that if you're writing about yourself, you know, like, you have to sort of reveal all the blemishes and ugliness of yourself. And I think that actually kind of draws people in more and makes them feel,
yeah,
you know, because it's boring and it's and it's pretentious for someone to write about themselves and make themselves like this heroic, you know, semi-flawless kind of person. But
one might argue the reverse, too, that it is also pretentious to write about oneself in an absolutely over-the-top, perhaps, or even like just revealing every single wart. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know you don't do that in this book, but nevertheless, if this book is not therapeutic, as you say, and you're revealing all this stuff about yourself, is that this goes back to a confessional issue, essentially. And in the question I had asked you earlier about what is it to write something or to tap into emotion through text when you're an entirely different man now than you were as a boy or as a teenager or as a young man. Mm-hmm. What really is that? I mean, there's got to be some kind of emotional incongruity to some degree.
I don't know. I'm not really sure how to answer that. I think I guess one of the things that I set out to do and that I wanted to do was to reveal these things about myself and you know, also to talk about, you know, like these kind of struggles that everyone has and just kind of share these sort of common things that, you know, a lot of readers have a lot of these kind of story threads in common with me. A lot of people that have read the book have, you know, usually one of the first things they'll say is like, oh, I remember when I did something like that too, or like, oh, that chapter you about this is just like something that happened to me or whatever. So I don't know. I don't know if I necessarily had like a specific aim or goal when I was like revealing all this stuff. I just, I don't know. I mean, part of it is like an entertainment factor, and some of it is just, you know, the fact that you know, people like to you know, read the nitty gritty about, you know, what you've done and
so you enjoy revealing all these naughty bits about yourself, but you like entertaining in this manner. That's quite interesting.
I think it's funny. I mean, I think people enjoy that. They can laugh at me, but they can also laugh because they've probably felt that same feeling or they've experienced those same things. It's the same kind of feeling like when I read stuff by like Jonathan Ames or Kevin Keck, who's one of my favorite writers. You know, even people like David Sedaris or whatever, you read these sort of like misadventures by these people and you laugh, you know, even if they're really embarrassing for the person at the time or whatever. I don't know. I don't feel like, you know, I'm going to tell you this story, but you better not laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
I have an odd question for you. I'm wondering what word unit allowed you to best access the past. Was it possibly a verb or a noun or a modifier? Were there specific situations in which maybe one word unit was better than the other? I'm just curious based off of the sort of straightforward language that you use in the book.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not really sure. I haven't really thought about it in that way. I guess, you know, maybe just more like nouns, you know, probably. You know, there's house fire, there's my brothers, there's football, there's acid trips, there's dirty magazines, you know, like, you know, there's all these things that are nouns. So I don't know, I guess that would probably be the most obvious answer for me.
There was also one other quality that I found interesting, and that was the fact that this book very rarely, at least not to my immediate observation, it does not pass judgment from your present vantage point upon your past actions. Mm-hmm. And yet, there are certain instances in which there are judgmental aspects from the past, that even trash talking. And I'm wondering, were there any particular ground rules that you set to establish a no commentary principle when writing this, or did it just essentially come out in this sort of straightforward manner? I'm curious about this.
I don't know. I think I, you know, some of these pieces, I felt like I didn't necessarily need to like spell it out so much or really make it or really even just announce, like, this was an embarrassing moment for me, or, you know, I was shocked at my dad, or, you know, like, I just think, like, when you're telling stories about things that happen, you just tell the story, and you don't necessarily need to say, like, oh, I felt embarrassed, or, like, I was turned on, or whatever. Like, I think people kind of get that.
But years later, you probably resent, for example, being fleeced for a supposed abortion and things like that. Yeah. And so I'm curious what you did to contain yourself from, like, saying, oh, I was such an idiot, or something along those lines.
I think that's kind of like, if I did that, it would feel really, it would have felt really different from the rest of the book if I would have allowed myself to do that. I didn't necessarily set down rules like, oh, I can't comment or, like, you know, commentate on these things. I think I just, you know, maybe it was just the fact that I had already written a chunk of these things, and I had this sort of, like, minimal style for these stories, and it worked well, I wouldn't say easy, but it was somewhat easy for me to write some of these chapters because it's very simple stuff. I think, I probably could have, like, especially as I got older, you know, some of those feelings I probably, I could have accessed, you know, and I think I probably did as I was writing some of those chapters, you know, some of those things about, like, girlfriend stuff, heartbreak, things like that. But I don't think they necessarily need that kind of extra commentary or that extra, you know, like, fluffy
nagging finger patty. Kind of thing.
Yeah. I don't know. I felt like the writing is stronger if you don't, like, have to, you know, like, really point it out to people what you're trying to say. I don't know. It just kind of came naturally. As I wrote, you know, the book, that style just became more and more easy for me to access. And I would obviously know that there were certain times when I might want to say something snarky or something like that. And I really tried not to do that so much.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, let's move on to the mathematical precision that is often in this book. I mean, it starts from the beginning with Alinda, where you note that her weight, when she gained weight at Medical Lake, and that it was almost precise mathematical terms that you used. When she began there, she weighed 98 pounds. 2 years later, she weighed 200. Likewise, when you first describe coming to Seattle, you describe a girl like this: her large black father and her humorless-looking white mother sneered at me. Then, of course, there's Pam, the flight. You know, you got a sort of two extremes, and then, you know, we're looking, perhaps zeroing in on the gray areas. Then with Pam, you, of course, have this obsession with numbers and the number of times you have copulated with her or made love, to use a more pleasant term. So the question I have involving this precision is, why do you think that it exists? Does it allow you to concentrate more on these gray areas, on these things that aren't so precise, emotionally speaking?
I don't know. I think for those particular examples, I think it was just because I did have exact numbers, or, like, the Alinda chapters, like the chapters about Alinda, those were written mostly through doing the interviews with her and what she would tell me about this stuff. And I talked to my mom about Alinda and her experiences as well, and so my mom told me some of this stuff, and then I went and I interviewed Linda, and she told me some of these things too. So the whole thing about her weight gain, I think, came from an interview, one of the interviews I had with Linda, where she told me, like, you know, I weighed this much, and then when I got out, I weighed 200 pounds. So that's, you know, those are facts that I got directly from her. And then what was the other thing? the Jehovah's Witness girl in Seattle with the black father and the stern looking white mother. I don't know. There's nothing really mathematical about that. It was just
ironic. Well, it's two extremes phrased in such a way, so you have this balance in terms of black, white, and then of course, I mean, I just noticed a concern for precision throughout this memoir along these lines, which which is why I'm wondering if precision allows you to become more imprecise or emotionally speaking.
I don't know. I think there's just sometimes when I do remember things that are precise, and there are sometimes when I don't, and so I don't get precise about every little detail in the book, of course, but the 63 times thing about Pam, I mean, I remember that because it was just such a it was just such a funny thing, and like I say at the end of that chapter, it was like a number that just kind of disgusted me afterwards. And I just remember, I just remember that. And I remember it was a joke, and people and my friends would say 63 times. Yeah. And so, I don't know. It's just like, it was just one of those funny things like that. I have this weird thing sometimes too with numbers where I can remember numbers sometimes because I relate them to athletes and their like jersey numbers,
stats,
things like that. So that's kind of an odd thing. I don't know if the number 63, if I remembered it easier because 63, like in football terms, like a player that has number 63 is usually like some big ugly offensive lineman or something like that. And so usually
that's being a little sometimes prejudicial to I'm sure there's a perfectly handsome football player of 63. I was curious, what was it about the radio school instructor's body language that suggested a few divorces in his past? I bring this up because given how your family and your friends judged you, at least based off of my reading of the text, I obviously wasn't there, such as Pam claiming that, you know, her little brother had beat you up. Isn't there a certain paradox in ascribing such judgment to others within the text like this? Or do you exonerate yourself from the judgment because, as we've been discussing, well, you're doing candor without commentary?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I should say, or we should say, that there is no commentary throughout the book, because there probably are a few times where there is some kind of like understated commentary or you know, maybe some snarky comments. The radio TV teacher that I had, I totally remember him as being, you know, this kind of Marlboro Man kind of guy, and he did have this sort of posture that was kind of slouchy and sort of defeated, and you know, he seemed like a little, you know, he was like I think he's probably like in his 50s or something like that, and he just kind of had like this sort of like sloppiness to him that
maybe he was happily married and he just didn't like his job. I had a few divorces in his life. That's pretty judgmental, man.
Yeah, I don't know. I just I think as a kid, when you see people like that, like, you know, most of you, a lot of my teachers anyway, I remember as being like fairly upbeat, you know, maybe stern, you know, maybe a little cheery or whatever. And then there are some that just seemed worn out. Mm-hmm. And he just kind of seemed, I just remember him being this kind of worn out kind of character. I liked him a lot.
But how do you get from worn out to divorce?
Well, you know, I don't know. Maybe that's just my adult perspective, like, seeping
into it. There is commentary. I see.
Because there's commentary in other places, too. I mean, like, the chapter about the prostitute. I mean, there's a couple of, like, I'm sure, sort of snarky comments about her. And, you know, there's snarky comments about me throughout the book as well. Yeah. But
well, let's be clear on this. I mean, is self-deprecatory comments about yourself really, is that snark? I mean,
I don't know. I'm not sure what you'd call it.
Self-arc? I don't know. Tater Nuts begins with a line, "This is how I learned about cunnilingus from a policeman's wife and became a legendary friar at the same time." Now, that's an opening line that, it reminded me of Anthony Burgess's Earthly Powers, that famous line. But it invites the reader
to plunge further, and yet other sections don't quite have that lead. And I'm curious why you felt particularly compelled to grab the reader by the lapels with that particular section.
Oh, I don't know. That is kind of interesting, I guess. When I write fiction, I am a firm believer that the first sentence should be really strong. And that sort of comes from, you know, the Gordon Lish, you know, Gary Lutz, Diane Williams school of writing or whatever is like that. That's what you're supposed to do is like have a really great first line and build your story sentence by sentence. I don't necessarily do that in this book. But in fact, a lot of the first lines in this book, a lot of the first lines in the chapters, I think are probably pretty simple. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I was really conscious of the fact that was like such a, you know, like sped up first line or whatever. But,
yeah.
I don't know. I don't mind that though. I mean, I think it's kind of fun to read stuff and to create stuff that does that, where there are certain parts that are a little slower and you know, more simple, and then there's some parts where it just like speeds up and kind of you know, takes you somewhere fast. And I've always I think that's really great to do that. So I guess in a way I'm glad I'm glad I threw in something like that amidst some of these more simple sentences that populate the book.
It was sort of the variety impulse that also led you to do that list of things that you thought about when in mass and things like you wanted to have at least one little chapter that was different from the other. Maybe that might have been the motivation for that opening line or...
Yeah, and some of these chapters honestly were written as standalone kind of essays or even like I think even actually the Tater Nuts chapter I wrote initially even though it's nonfiction, I wrote it and published it on a website as a short story. Mm-hmm. And not to say that it was labeled fiction on the website or anything, but I just wrote it and it got published as a short story. So that chapter, the things I think about in church and probably a couple of other chapters where it's written more like kind of standalone pieces.
A series of questions that as well, yeah.
Which one is that?
There's a series of questions. There's a series of questions. I know this. God.
There is?
Yeah, there is. I hallucinated it. No, I'm. It comes after the things you thought about at church.
Oh.
I know it's here.
Are you thinking about the Padgett Powell book?
No, I'm thinking about the Gilbert Sorrentino book. That's because... oh, no, the Country Music Memories. That's what I'm thinking of.
Oh, okay. Another kind of list thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That was also a kind of a standalone thing at one point. I admit that there's, like, something a little weird about, like, writing these standalone pieces. And then, like... you know, like wedging them into a memoir or whatever. But I also knew that those pieces were true stories when I wrote them. And as I was putting together the book, I thought that the Tater Nuts thing would be a really funny chapter. And I think it fits pretty well. You know, tonally, I think it fits with a lot of the stuff around that part of the book and everything. So, I could have been forcing it into the flow of the book a little bit, but I think it worked out.
I'm curious about a very strange reference you used when you're talking about your accelerated need for pornography. You refer to Ted Bundy as a comparative point, and given that the fact that the book is titled A Common Pornography, Ted Bundy is not what I would call common, unless, of course, you were a neighbor before his little crimes were revealed. So I'm curious about that.
The whole Ted Bundy thing, I just remember, I'm not sure what year did he get caught? I can't remember. But I remember I was, it must have been around the time when I was like, you know, 17, 18, or 19 or something like that. But I remember having these thoughts in my head. as I was, you know, obsessed with these images you know, looking at these magazines, I remember having this idea in my head, like, oh, I'm getting bored of some of this kind of plain pornography. I need something that's more raunchy or whatever. And so, like, and I remember that, like, feeling like, oh, this is, like, it's true what they say. It's like a gateway drug. It's like if you smoke pot, then you'll want to do coke, and then you'll want to do heroin. And, you know, and it's like, I don't necessarily know if I really believe that now so much, but I remember thinking that at one time about pornography.
Yeah.
Because I remember when Bundy was about to be executed, and he supposedly had an interview or confession thing, and I remember, I don't know if you remember this, but I remember he tried to sort of like blame a lot of stuff on pornography.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting, because on the other side of the fence, you have these other people that are are pro pornography or pro express, you know, freedom of expression or whatever, and then you have this camp of feminist thinkers who think that pornography is harmful to women, and yeah, it's really interesting, all that baggage that comes from pornography, especially in that time frame. It seemed like there was a lot of argument about it.
I know you used a suitcase. Is that why there's this baggage term? Right.
Oh, I know.
You're going to forever associate pornography with anyone. In fact, I actually wanted to ask you about that. I mean, you maintained a really meticulous filing system with your peachy folders. I'm wondering if any of that came into later use during your tenure at Future Tense, whether you remained that organized, and whether manuscripts could be organized in a similar fashion, or whether you're perhaps carrying manuscripts right now as you were about to leave New York in a suitcase in a similar manner. No, I don't. You tell me, sir.
I have peachies. I do have peachies at home that have some manuscripts and things like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think peachies are they're kind of a funny thing. I don't know if a lot of people actually have said that they don't know what peachies are.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I had peachies. I grew up in the time of peachies, so I understand what they are. I wonder if it's a West Coast, East Coast thing to some degree.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Huh.
So, but I'm fairly well organized when it comes to Future Tense stuff. I do have a lot of manuscripts and submissions and queries and things like that to go through. A lot of times they're just like on my computer. So I don't have like stacks of paper and peachies and things like that at home. So,
well, the underlying suggestion to this line of questioning is whether some of these seemingly sordid things that you were writing about were prototypes for, I suppose, more stable or more positive, or I don't want to use the term less perverse, but let's just say that they were quirks in early formation that allowed you to become who you are right now, and whether that really was one of the reasons why this, you know, one of the key things you may have discovered while writing this memoir.
Yeah, so I could do all of that stuff and have this kind of perverse youth and infatuation with pornography and all these sordid affairs and you know, girlfriends or whatever, so I could be a totally normal 42-year-old, which I am now. I'm totally...
You're totally normal.
I don't have any sort of, like, weird quirks or flaws.
Not weird at all? Not strange?
No. It's all very... you just Harvard reach
demand,
a part...
You signed the contract that you were normal?
You just reach a part of your life where everything... You know, just becomes really normal, and you know, you watch TV and eat dinner and raise a son.
So why the hell am I interviewing you? No. I mean, no. Seriously. I mean, you know, you can. Yes, obviously, we mellow as we get older. But on the other hand, I mean, you know, are you holding back on us here, Kevin? You're waiting 10 years from now, we'll get another book that will reveal that you're even more fucked up now than you were even your 20s.
See, that's why I'm waiting, because I have to wait a while to, you know, realize that some of the fucked up stuff now, and then I can write about it. It's too early for me to write about it now, because I haven't self-reflected on it enough, so...
Well, not just self-reflection, but did you get permission from the people you wrote about to include them in the book? I'm curious how what kind of clearance. I mean, obviously, some of these people couldn't be tracked down.
Yeah, no, I mean, there were a few people that are in the book that I'm still friends with. Some people,
a
that,
few,
that, well, you know, a handful. You know, some of them you lose track of, and then they, you know,
be careful.
So, but no, there's some of my friends that are in the book. They knew I was writing it. I don't think there's anything really bad about any of the friends in there. Except for the Maurice character, who I was like best friends with in high school, and I actually reconnected with him just like in the last year or so on Facebook, and became friends with him, and you know, kind of reluctantly, because he was kind of an asshole toward the end of our friendship, and he would always get drunk, and he was really mean, and it was just like, you know, I don't need to be friends with you anymore. You know, I just have like, it was just one of those relationships where it was really strange. I don't know if I've ever had a relationship like that where someone turned so sour that I had to like just stop speaking with them. But that's the way it ended, you know, like 20 years ago or whenever it was. But we reconnected in the last year or so. And, you know, and I was trying to be friendly. I was like, oh, hey, you know, you sent me the friend request. You extended your hand, so I'm gonna accept this, and you know, what's going on with you? How come you don't have any pictures on your Facebook page? You know, like, what are you doing? Like, your Facebook page is really minimal and mysterious, you know. And he wouldn't really like answer my questions. He would kind of send me like these really short replies, and then, you know, like, I noticed he would comment on these things on my page, and he would like leave these really weird, like passive aggressive kind of like comments on my status updates and stuff like that. And it was really obnoxious. And then finally he said something that was just too smart-assy, and it was just like, screw you. And I just like, you know, defriended him or whatever. But that was like, that's really the only time that I've had like a weird kind of reaction. So I changed his name. His real name's not Maurice, it's something else. And so I made sure to change his name in the book because I didn't want him to
find you on like, Facebook again.
Freak out and send me a dead rabbit in the mail or something. Yeah. But
he may be listening to this right now.
He might be.
Well, Maurice, we love you. Don't leave Kevin alone.
And yeah, there was a few other people, and there was like a couple of well, at least one old girlfriend that I am friends with, and I talked to her about things, and kind of like got some stories from her. The chapter where the girlfriend goes and gets the abortion, and she, and there's the part in that chapter where she talks about, you know, having this vision in her head as she's starting to fade before the operation, and that's included in the book. And that's obviously something that I couldn't have known, you know, unless I talked to her, you know. And yeah, there's a few other people that I reconnected with, and I would ask questions and stuff. Mm. Yeah, most people were excited about being in the book, I think.
Did they find that their memories matched your own, or that they were surprised by your own particular impression?
Yeah, I had
they had no idea what was going inside your head?
Well, actually, that same girl sent me a message a couple weeks ago, you know, after the book had been out for a couple weeks. And she said, oh, I really loved your book. It made me cry. I don't remember doing some of these things to you, but they sound true, and after all, I was only 19 or something like yeah. that. And so that was, you know, that was kind of interesting. I mean, the way she said it, like, I don't quite remember, but it sounds true. It sounds like something I would do.
She's willing to believe you.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, I don't know, I haven't really had any other people say oh, that's not what happened. Yeah. But and I'm sure, you know, some of the stories, there could be, you know, things where other people in the stories might see something a little differently.
But this also brings up the common problem when dealing with the self, and that is what is important to you or what is not important to you may not necessarily reflect what is important to other people, you know, not remembering how these, what things that are done, these sort of trivial things for this girl, right? Mm-hmm. But for you, they were everything. And so I'm wondering if that presents a particular problem in putting yourself out there, in letting some other people know this is how I felt, or maybe that isn't such a concern. Maybe you can talk about whether that's important or not.
Well, I don't think I really say anything about in the book about like what other people are feeling, unless it was something that I got through an interview or whatever. Like there's a couple of chapters about a Linda, my sister, and she, you know, like there are some things in there that I couldn't have known, but she told them to me in the interview, and she told me how she felt about certain things. And so I put those in there. And I think in the introduction to the book, too, I even say, like, even though, like, I say some of these things about what people are feeling, it's not speculation on my part. It was things that I got through interviews. I didn't feel the need to necessarily ask people for approval of, like, how I would portray them or, like, you know, how I saw them in these certain scenes, you know. You just can't do that, you know. I mean, I didn't show the book. I didn't show, like, the manuscript or the review copies to any of my family because I didn't want them to say, like, oh, you shouldn't put that part in there because it's too shameful for your dad, or, like, why did you put that part in there because, you know, it's embarrassing to your mom or whatever. I mean, I tried to handle all that stuff with as much care as I could. And I don't think I necessarily paint anyone in a really negative light, unless it's something that they just did in the book. One of my older brothers, Mark, is not portrayed very well in the book, but I think that's mainly illustrated through some of his actions. And
I'm wondering if, and this is going to be my final question to close this off, whether this ability on your part to really push yourself further, to write without anybody seeing it really, or without having that sense of approval, that this was a natural step forward for you in order to pursue some even grander or more ambitious project, something in which, okay, I've went ahead and I've just put it all on the line here with this book. Now I know I can now step things up to the next level. Would you say that something along these lines occurred that you, in the aftermath of this?
I've thought about that. I've thought about that a little bit with this book. I've actually thought about that a little more in the past with some of the fiction that I've written. I've had two books of short stories published by small presses in the last couple of years before this book. And I think, you know, and that was kind of my first love with writing, was writing fiction and stuff. And I think I'm more aware of that when I'm writing fiction. I think if I can push myself to talk about certain things in fiction that might be disturbing or shocking or something to people, I think it kind of helps me to feel the freedom to do whatever I want to writing wise after that, you know. It's one of those things, like there's a story in Beautiful Blemish, the title story, about the old people that are having sex, and they're talking dirty to each other, and they're like drawing, they're like writing stuff on their bodies with magic markers and stuff. It's a really like just raunchy, just wild story. But I kind of felt like when I put that story in there and published it, I kind of thought like, oh, that's a crazy story. And some people are, you know, some people may really hate it and be really disgusted by it. But then, you know, and I put it out, and the feedback for that story specifically was really good. But, you know, you have these fears about things that you put out there because they're so far out,
yeah,
or they're so bizarre. And if you put them out there, then there's nothing you can do. You can't take it back. And so you put it out there, and if people freak out about it, then, you know, that's their problem, and you just come back with something else, and hopefully you've broken that wall so that you can do something weird and far out again if you want to. I don't think it necessarily, I don't think that if that story would have been received with a really negative reaction from people,
yeah,
I don't know if that would have necessarily made me not want to go that far again.
But have you written anything that you would want to take back?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there's some things that I've written that, you know, like, that might not be that good, you know? And maybe just aren't very well-written stories or very, very strong stories, like, you know, stuff from my early, early writing. I feel pretty good about the writing that I've done, you know, in the last, like, 5 or 10 years. And so if I feel good enough about a story, and if I actually finish a story, then I don't ever really feel that embarrassed by it or put it away. I mean, I guess I have maybe a couple of times, but those are stories that I just never sent out and probably won't publish. You know, there are a couple of failures in the bunch, but most of the time I'm not super embarrassed about things, you know.
You feel you have a good mechanism in place to prevent something that's either poorly written or perhaps unwise to put out to the universe from actually making its way.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's some stuff that I've done that's poorly written or not well executed. But, you know, maybe I published that stuff like 10 years or so ago, and maybe I'm not concerned about it anymore. Like, hardly anyone probably has read any of my stuff that is, you know, that old anyway, you know. So there's nothing you can really do about it. It's like, if you're going to be a writer and you're going to write for a long time, then, you know, you're going to have stuff that eventually you're going to be embarrassed about, or you're not going to feel as super great. I mean, I started publishing stuff in little magazines like in 1990, so I've been doing it for about 20 years, but I didn't really think of myself as a writer for a long time, you know, even until like the last few years. You know, I just kind of felt like I didn't write enough to really call myself a writer, you know.
You didn't write enough, or you didn't write something that was on that level of, I'm a writer, Kevin Samson.
Well, I don't know. I think part of it is that I have this, for a long time I had this thing in my head that told me, you know, if I can't be a writer unless I've published a couple of novels and done all this type of stuff. But, yeah, I mean, I published, you know, Beautiful Blemish and Creamy Bullets. I think probably around the time when, like, Creamy Bullets came out, I probably started to feel a little bit more comfortable saying that I'm a writer, because I actually had a couple of books out.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Before that, it was like I had a bunch of chapbooks out and things like that. And chapbooks are great, but I guess my confidence level wasn't super high for a while. Plus, I do a lot of other stuff. You know, I work at Powell's and I publish stuff. So I've always kind of like, I always felt like that stuff was what I did more, you know? So, usually I would introduce myself as, oh, I work at Powell's, or, you know, like I work at a bookstore, you know, like I never really said like, I'm a writer.
But at the end of the day, now you would say I'm a writer.
I think I still sort of lead off by saying I work at Powell's and I do this. And then, you know, if I feel confident enough in the conversation, I'll say like, oh yeah, I actually wrote a book, and, you know, I'm still sort of like, I don't know, I'm still kind of a little sheepish about talking about that stuff sometimes with people. I don't know, it's weird. But I don't know, what to say about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when do you think you can say I'm a writer instead of I work at PALS, or I'm a writer who happens to work at PALS?
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe you can interchange it, you know? Yeah. Maybe you can get like a list that you can carry along, like sort of like the deaf person who in the streets who asks, so he says, I'm sorry, I'm going to a very terrible place.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's sort of an outside perspective. Like, if I'm looking at someone who, like Justin Taylor, you know, who I've read with a couple times on this tour, he just put out his first book, and it's a collection of short stories. It's not super long or anything. And he's a young guy. And yet, you know, maybe at his age, if I would have put out a book like that, I probably wouldn't have seen myself as a writer. But me looking at him now with this book out, and it's a great book, I would say, oh yeah, you know, I would introduce him to people as a writer.
Yeah.
You know, even though he just has like the one book and he has like a small poetry collection. And so, but myself, if I had a book and a poetry collection, I would feel weird about calling myself a writer.
Huh.
I don't know.
You know, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with the writer, Kevin Samsel. Kevin, thanks so much for taking the time out.
Thank you very much.
Okay.